Monster Man, Episode 76, Fiend Folio Introduction. Stop hissing with the Monster Man, it was a bad plan, but I had to get the town on it. Hey everybody, it's your old pal James from the future here. Before we get started with today's episode, I have a little bit of housekeeping to take care of. First off, I wanted to say that parts of this episode and parts of some future episodes are going to be recorded while my neighbors are doing some renovations. Now, hopefully it shouldn't be too bad, but you may hear in the distance the unpredictable sound of power tools or hammers, and I'll try to take out as much of it as I can, but a little bit may get through, and anyway, that's what's happening. The other thing is that since I recorded this episode, I've had some listener mail about my episodes about the ecology articles, and I thought I'd respond to those. And finally, we've got a new Patreon sponsor to thank. So before we get started, let's just do those. Listener mail-wise, I got a couple of emails defending the ecology articles against what I admitted was some pretty harsh criticism. Edwin King writes, without wanting to defend the stodgy text or poor editorial control of the articles, can I suggest something that might mitigate the repetition of details from the Monster Manual? That is, that these magazine articles are meant as entry-level info for those who play the game but don't have access to the Monster Manual. When I was playing in the 80s, only the DM or the aspiring DMs splashed out on the manuals. Indeed, to do so was seen denoting a certain mark of commitment. The DMs guarded the info in those volumes. It was part of their mystique. For the rest of us, game information wasn't as ubiquitous as it is now. We could quite easily meet monsters several times before we worked out what they were and what their weaknesses might be. To be able to pick up a magazine for a few quid rather than the cost of the manual was a great boon, and perhaps this also explains why the articles are framed as in-game narratives, the idea being that the ecology article contains the information an adventurer might pick up through the course of their career, either by listening to tales from one-armed bards or by delving into learned tomes. Well, I think that's a really interesting point, and it's similar to the one made by my next correspondent, that's Goblin's Henchman, who says something similar. I get what you're saying in your review of Dragon's Ecology-type articles. Yes, they were a bit stuffy. Yes, they were restricted by typecast, having to fit in with the established text. Yes, some of them could have been more creative or adventurous, but what I think is missing in your analysis, at least for me, is time and context. Sure, in 2018, with the creative cauldron that is G+, etc., ideas are popping up left, right, and center. Anything too verbose tends to get the elbow aside, because something short and snappy is bidding for attention. Rewind, arcane term, to the 80s when I was a kid, I was so pleased to get a hold of my Dragon magazine. My mate bought White Dwarf, so we recovered. When I got my mitts on those pages, I wanted to run off to a quiet place and dig in. The next package of RPG goodness was a good month away. If the Ecology of the Umber Hulk was a snappy 6 bullet points long, I'd be totally nonplussed. Also, I think these articles help to teach folks to think beyond the quarter-page description in the Monster Manual, something most of your target audience does naturally nowadays. And I think, I mean, both of these amount to acceptable in the 80s, but I think, you know, that is a good point, right? I am reading these and in many ways finding the brief but evocative descriptions in the Monster Manual fascinating from the perspective of someone whose problem is being saturated with gaming material. I own or could own more games than I could ever read or play. There's even more good games now than I could ever read or play. Not just more games, but more good games. That's a really remarkable position to find myself in. And as a result, you know, although I find the verbosity of AD&D charming, what I'm really interested in is its efficiency, because in many ways it is quite an efficient game. And it's helpful to be reminded that in some ways these are intended to, like, parcel out little drips of information to players and also to kind of while away the time. If you're thinking about it from a younger reader's perspective, if you're thinking about it from a younger gamer's perspective, and if you're thinking about it in terms of the kind of game information landscape of the era, then, yeah, maybe these articles do make a bit more sense. So, thanks for the messages. I also want to thank new Patreon supporter Eric Telvola. And Eric, I'm very sorry if I mispronounced your last name. If, like Eric, you want to support the show, you can go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge as little as $1 a month. And if, like Eric, you pledge at the $2 level or higher, you'll also get access to my other show, Patron Deities, which is about to begin a new season about Finnish mythology. I now return you to your regularly scheduled episode. Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through 1980s Fiend Folio in this second season of the show.
In today's episode, we're going to do a quick introduction to the Fiend Folio before we get started on the monsters themselves in the next episode. The monster manual itself basically needs no introduction, but I feel like the Fiend Folio is a little bit more obscure and therefore probably worth talking about. I wanted to talk about how it came to be, what it is, and how I anticipate that it's going to wind up being different from the Monster Manual, because the thing about the Fiend Folio is that by its very nature, it's not going to give us the same kind of results that we saw in the first season. Like, in some ways, it's going to be a little more varied, and in other ways, it's going to feel... Well, we'll see. So, what is the deal with the Fiend Folio? The Fiend Folio came out in 1981. I think that back in episode 73, I said 1980, but that's not correct. It was originally slated to come out much earlier than that. The Fiend Folio was the big flagship product from TSR's UK division, based right here in Cambridge and headed up by Don Turnbull. The early British D&D scene had been dominated by the company that would go on to basically dominate British gaming forever, Games Workshop. Now, if you know Games Workshop today, you think of it as the company that makes the Warhammer family of games, let's call them. But it wasn't always that. In fact, when it got started, Games Workshop made traditional games, and then it got into the fantasy role-playing field. And it was the two heads of Games Workshop at that time, Steve Jackson and Ian Livingston, also responsible for the creation of Fighting Fantasy, who launched the magazine White Dwarf, which of course today focuses on Warhammer games, but at that time was a kind of general role-playing and board game magazine, and it was very focused on Dungeons and Dragons. And in White Dwarf, there was a column called The Fiend Factory, which was a bunch of basically freelancer and readers submitted monsters for Dungeons and Dragons. Now, some of the monsters in the Fiend Folio, I believe, did in fact see print in The Fiend Factory. Others were ones that were submitted, but Turnbull liked them so much that he decided that he would just, you know, keep them aside and release them in the book. And even the ones that were in the Fiend Factory aren't necessarily quite the same in their appearance in the Fiend Folio, as we shall see. I think in our first episode there's one, at least one. Publication was originally scheduled, I believe, for 1979, but complicated legal wranglings delayed it until 1981, and that, I think, was to do with the idea that TSR wanted to establish a British presence. It was clear that there was a strong British market for D&D. And initially, I think they were intending to do this via a merger with Games Workshop, but when that didn't happen, they then set up their own UK division. And it was basically that process that slowed the release of the Fiend Folio. That is my understanding, but if someone wants to correct me, I'm not an expert. And in many ways, it's these factors that contribute to what makes the Fiend Folio interesting, and interestingly different from its predecessor. So let's go down the list. First off, the Fiend Folio is secondary. What that means is that it's, you know, in some ways, it's that difficult second album. By this I mean that if you look at the Monster Manual, all the obvious stuff is in the Monster Manual. Dragons, Monster Manual. Ghosts, Monster Manual. Orcs, Monster Manual. Hobgoblins, Monster Manual. Bears and wolves and rhinos and cheetahs, Monster Manual. Humans, Monster Manual. So the vast majority of things that are going to be the kind of basic building blocks of your monster campaign are going to be in the Monster Manual. And monsters in the Fiend Folio therefore sort of recognize that. There are a few that could wind up being kind of core monsters for your campaign, but for the most part they're a little bit more exotic. And the few of them, although there are some, that are based on folklore and mythology. And we'll see that the folkloric and mythological monsters of the Fiend Folio tend to be taken from kind of other parts of the world that weren't addressed in as great detail in the Monster Manual. Second, it's a compilation. Now, it's obviously not the case that every monster in the Monster Manual, you know, sprung fully formed from the brow of Gygax. We've seen that there are things that come from, you know, Blackmoor. We've seen that there are things that are the creation of, you know, other scenario authors. But there's certainly more of a unifying creator and editorial hand in the Monster Manual than there is in the Fiend Folio. By its nature, the Fiend Folio is a compilation, a collection of things by a range of different authors. And I'm not going to list them all here because there are a huge number. But people credited in the Fiend Folio include some TSR US types. So, for example, Gary Gygax and Lawrence Schick, but also a lot of people who played an important role at Games Workshop. So most obviously Ian Livingston, but also Albie Fiore. Is it Fiore or Fior? I don't know. I think it's Fiore. Lou Pulsifer, the great evangelist of D&D in the 70s in the UK. And Also, you know, people who would go on to be very prominent in the British gaming scene, like Phil Masters, and people who go on to be prominent in other ways, like Charles Stross. So, by its very nature, the Fiend Folio is a compilation. It's a bit more patchwork than the already, frankly, pretty patchwork Monster Manual. So we have to be on the lookout for that, on the ways that it makes the Fiend Folio interesting. Thirdly, the Fiend Folio is British, whereas the Monster Manual is American. Now that sounds weird, but it's actually, I think it's really significant. I know that on this podcast previously, I have referenced the Grognard Files, a podcast that deals with, you know, old school gaming, particularly gaming of the 80s, and particularly British gaming. And it was very interesting to me to be listening to an interview on a recent episode in which the host said, you know, oh, the players will refuse to engage with this if there isn't a certain level of cynicism and irony, which I don't think would have been true of American gamers in this era necessarily, right? I remember many years ago now reading an article by, I want to say it was by Greg Kostikian, in, I think, an old issue of Different Worlds, in which he talked about the idea of there being distinctive regional patterns of RPG play. Now, whether this is true or not, I couldn't tell you, but he seemed to suggest that, you know, in the Midwest, you got pretty much straight-ahead old-school fantasy adventure gaming. In California, you got these obsessives, your Chaosium types, whose thing was, you know, setting recreation and caring a lot about history, and, you know, the people who made games like, you know, Pendragon, and, I mean, I think he's mainly just talking about Greg Stafford, really. And then in New York, you had people who were interested in the idea of the game as a game, where, like, the role-playing nature of it was part of the, like, almost a meta-commentary, and where there was a level of ironic detachment. Now, again, I couldn't tell you whether those regional playstyles really existed, but it's certainly true, I think, that British gaming, apparently right from its inception, has always been more interested in the absurd, the grotesque, and the pathetic than its American counterpart. And in many ways, you can see that as AD&D shifts into its more kind of, I don't know, family-friendly might not be the right word, but there's certainly, you know, as AD&D becomes squeakier clean in the mid to late 80s, that British gaming's response is Warhammer fantasy roleplay, which is the opposite of that. You know, it was this tale of rat catchers and highwaymen trying to stop the horrible gods of chaos, engaged in cutthroat intrigues and trade swindles and all this stuff, right? That it's seedier than its American counterpart. And it's simultaneously both more grotesque and sillier. Maybe what I mean to say is that an audience raised on, like, 2000 AD and Monty Python and stuff is always going to be more comfortable with the idea that the horrid and the silly can coexist effectively. And certainly I think there was a lot of objection to some of the silliness, the perceived silliness anyway, of the Fiend Folio when it came out, of which more anon. Finally, and most importantly, the Fiend Folio is in conversation with the Monster Manual in a way that the Monster Manual is not in conversation with anything, right? So the Fiend Folio is necessarily a response to the Monster Manual and a response to the habits of play that have developed after 4 years of the Monster Manual being out in the world. As we go through the Fiend Folio, and again, I think in our first episode, we're going to see monsters which are essentially reactions to monsters that are in the Monster Manual. And sometimes that's as simple as something like the Vodianoi, like, oh, look, it's an Umber Hulk, but it's a water Umber Hulk. And sometimes there's a lot of, like, gotcha creatures. So it's like, oh, well, you thought it was a this, but it's actually a that. Gotcha. And in some ways, this reflects a mature game culture in a way that the Monster Manual kind of doesn't, that there are established conventions of play that in some ways the Fiend Folio seeks to trap or counter or subvert. And that, I think, is what Ed Greenwood meant when, in his review of the Fiend Folio, he said that there were a lot of monsters that are just gamey. They don't make sense if you're thinking of them as creatures who exist within an imaginary environment. They only make sense as opponents in a D&D game. They exist in response not to the fantasy setting, not to the narrative, if narrative there is, but to the game. And in fact, we're going to see maybe a little bit of one of those in our first episode, and the mother of all examples of that in our second episode. Now, that is in some ways a criticism, but it also means that the Fiend Folio basically has an additional level of complexity compared to the Monster Manual. That is to say that when we look at the Fiend Folio, we are not taking it solely on its own merits, but we have to think of it as something that is in conversation with the Monster Manual. And if you try to encounter the Fiend Folio by itself, you'll sort of, I think a lot of the time you'll think, what a load of nonsense. You have to think of it as something that is reacting to, commenting on, and responding to the content that's in the Monster Manual. So it's a good thing that we've spent 72 episodes talking, 73 if you count the zero episode, talking about the Monster Manual, because we now, I should think, have a pretty solid grounding in what is in that bad boy and are able to look at the Fiend Folio in light of that relationship. Okay? So those are the four key differences. The Fiend Folio is a compilation. The Fiend Folio is secondary. The Fiend Folio is British. And the Fiend Folio is in conversation with the Monster Manual. And I think if you look at the roles that all four of those factors play in the creation of this book, then we can get a little bit more insight into the weird and wonderful monsters in it. Because this has all been rather academic on my part, and I have not conveyed how absolutely excited I am to be starting on this. Because, you know, one of the things that you might get in a page of the Monster Manual is you would often just get like, oh yeah, it's a leopard. Oh yeah, it's a, you know, a leech, comma, giant. They're fine. They're great monsters. They're cool. But there's very little that I can say about them because they're so inherent to the adventure genre that there's not a lot to say about what's fun about a leopard. You already know what's fun about a leopard. But we're going to get some odd ducks in the Fiend Folio. Very few of them are literally ducks, like they were in the Monster Manual, but maybe one or two of them. So I'm really looking forward to seeing some of the bonkers creatures in this thing. I've prepped a couple of chapters ahead, but in later ones, I'm going to be as surprised as you are. So I'm really looking forward to you joining me as we begin our journey into the Fiend Folio in the next episode of Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. Do you have a favorite monster? Do you have something you'd like me to talk about? Find me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or send me an email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. If you want to support the podcast, you can do so at patreon.com/monsterman, where you'll find lots of extra bonus content and my brand new show, Patron Deities, in which I explore the deities and demigods advanced Dungeons & Dragons book. Check it out. Thanks for listening.